Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today, of course, I am joined by Sara Gant. Sara, how are you doing?
I'm fine, and as you'll hear, I brought my friend, friendly Hardy Da, along to express his views on current affairs. So,
Excellent. And we also have Mr. Gabriel Krauser, who is joining us today. What's going on, Gabriel?
I'm very grumpy.
I mean, any specific reason or just kind of with the general collapse of civilization that seems to be going on?
No, very specifically grumpy.
All right.
I'm very specifically grumpy.
Well, let us get into at least the cause of some of that grumpiness, perhaps. And that is the ongoing biggest issue in South Africa, our unemployment rate. So South Africa's unemployment rate has hit a record 34.9%, so basically 35% on the narrow definition. This is basically the highest ever. And on the expanded definition, it's now up to 46.6% of people are unemployed. Every single industry except the finance industry lost jobs in the second and third quarters of this year. And generally speaking, yeah, the situation is not looking good. Some 3.4 million people out of the 10 million young people between the ages of 15 and 24 were not in employment, education, or training. So we refer to those people as NEETs, NEET. And it's basically something a country should really be trying to avoid because this is the future of your workforce. Not good. Sara, your initial thoughts on hitting a record unemployment? I mean, we're not terribly surprised, are we?
We aren't terribly surprised. And with the pandemic and lousy government policy, I think every time unemployment figures come out, there'll be a new record because there is nothing in sight that would suggest that there's any way of arresting that. And the government may have created all sorts of plans and schemes and whatever they are, but they barely band-aid. I mean, you actually need to change the structure of the economy from a sort of semi-Marxist, don't know which way to go type, a bit of free market, a lot of red tape, etc. economy, to an economy that allows business to do business. And only if you get business to do business do you get business to create jobs. But I think there's a lack of appreciation by the government, and that's why they keep trying to employ people in the public service. That you don't employ people for the sake of employing people. You've got to have a purpose to employing people. So, in other words, you've got to have an entity or an organization, be profit making or non-profit making, who needs to employ people in order to carry out their function. And the more the private sector is allowed space to create business, the more people are going to be employed. I don't say it's the immediate, I don't say it's going to be the panacea. But it could certainly may stop us from having to go from one statistical revelation to another that just says we're on another record of unemployment. I mean, the fact that we have increasingly more people unemployed than employed is beyond disastrous.
So, I've been thinking a lot of recently about a country like India. Like South Africa, it's got quite a lot of diversity, much more than South Africa, even actually. It's really big, it's really chaotic. The government is not very functional, it's very corrupt. And yet, that country is on the rise in a lot of ways. And I think that the difference, really, at the end of the day, is that their unemployment rate is, I think, less than 10%, and their economic growth is like 7% or so.
We'll
And
take
it
it.
just shows, yeah, it just shows the difference really that economic growth and employment makes to a society. It changes the whole calculus. You go from a sort of hopeless malaise to one that's full of sort of potential and hope. Gabriel, I assume your grumpiness today is at least in part to do with this devastating stat that we're discussing today. Your thoughts on the unemployment?
Yeah, no, very much. I think that there's especially something to drill down into in terms of the NEETs, because the qualification that's used is, I think, generous. So if you look at Anthea Jeffrey's calculations, the number of youth that are effectively not developing skills is super majority. It's in the 70s. It's really safe to say most people my age and younger aren't working, aren't learning, aren't going forward in life. And I think that this overlaps with a line that we do often hear about South Africa, which is, this is a young democracy. This is like a teenage democracy. And there's this interesting transition from being a teenager and adolescent into being an adult. When you're an adolescent, your housing, your food, all of that good stuff, your education, what your clothes on your back, that's all coming from someone else. And mercifully, we don't live in a society where you have to start working when you're like 8 years old, right? You know, you get some childhood, you get some opportunities to learn about yourself, to explore, to make mistakes, pick yourself back up again, because someone has got your back. And that's sort of where South Africa was when this democracy was implemented. There was a lot of sympathy for it. And so a lot of mistakes could be papered over with a little bit of extra help from our friends. But there comes a point where you have to be an adult, where it's not good enough to actually just do enough to keep yourself going. You have to do enough to be creating a surplus. There is no way for a society with children and super old people to and disabled people and whatever to survive unless the average person is doing more than enough. And we're not doing that. Part of the reason I'm grumpy is it's close to the anniversary. I just was reminded it's close to the anniversary of a close friend of mine who killed himself because he couldn't find a job. And it took a few years and like in and out, but it didn't work out. And it just got to him because he'd gotten to an age where he could no longer look at himself in the mirror and believe in anything that he saw, because he was seeing a child with a beard. He was seeing a grown man living in the circumstance of a little child that needs to be fed and housed and clothed, that's not adding anything. It's very natural to want to add something. It's very unnatural to be held back from doing so. Now, the terrible thing is that so many people still think that the reason our unemployment rate is so high, the reason our economy is so sclerotic, is because of nefarious white monopoly capitalists or Western imperial forces or recalcitrant capitalists or, you know, greedy Scrooge McDucks. It's just universally the case that people who want to make money want to increase the number of customers they have, want to increase the skills in their workforce. They want all that good stuff. Selfishly, which happens to line up with the selfish interests of young men and women who would like to transfer from being adolescents to being adults. What's holding us back really is policy, our labor laws, our minimum wage, our promises of expropriation without compensation, national health insurance, the ways of chasing away investment that happen, even if you don't do the thing, but you just bring it up as a thing that could happen. And the consequences are dire, and it's quite deeply depressing. Makes me grumpy, and it makes me worry about the future. You know, 2024 is coming. I think the lesson from 2021 is that there's a real chance of a change in government, which would mean a change in policy. But there are many years between here and there, and there are many people whose lives are going to be lost. There's many consequences, crime, health, social dislocation that happened between now and then, and that happened even after then, because it's not a problem you can solve overnight. So it's not a surprise, but it's such a gloomy reminder of the dire state we're in.
Yeah, no, I think that's well said. We often, I think, when looking at the statistics, unless you are unemployed or know someone who's unemployed, and to be fair, a lot of South Africans do, most South Africans do, you can forget the very real cost that this does to people's lives. Even apart from things like suicide, there's also just kind of people who listlessly go on in their lives. They fall into alcoholism, drugs, that kind of thing, because they're unemployed.
Crime.
Crime, of course, as well. And this is a point of public policy discussion that really doesn't happen. People will sort of give lip service, I find, in a lot of kind of mainstream analysis to, well, there must be something about creating jobs or something. But then how to do that is always sort of a bit, you know, we'll make a program or something. And as you guys have said, you know, that's really not actually it. That ain't it, Chief, as the kids say. Sarah, your final thoughts.
Just to mention something that Gabriel didn't, and that is our education system. Two issues. The one is the fact that it has been experimented with. It was experimented with considerably in the first few years to our detriment, and then it's sort of limped along, and it's got progressively worse. It partly departmental, partly the fact that you have teachers who are inadequately trained or poorly execute their function. And then you have the problem which the government raised recently about people dropping out before matric. Now, there are two things about that. The first is that people are going to drop out before matric because they are not matric material, but then there should be tertiary education and training, that particularly training that they can drop out into, and that has whittled away completely. Again, the fault of the government. And the other thing, of course, is the very active involvement, and I've seen it myself, of the Department of Education, the various departments of education, sort of dropping people out before they get to matric so that they don't make the matriculation figures look bad. I mean, we need such a shake-up. I mean, let's put it this way. Irrespective of how good, bad, or indifferent Angie Moshecha is, she's been in the post for over 10 years. It's time for someone new to at least try and do something. But in the absence of that education, both primary, secondary, and some form of tertiary educational training, we are not an attractive destination.
If I can just add one quick point to that. So, sure. I mean, also our Minister of Employment and Labour, Tulis Nkwesi, is almost on the verge of getting the power to set race quotas and gender quotas and all kinds of quotas across the entire private sector through the Employment Amendment, the Employment Equity Amendment Bill, which the IRR is about to launch a campaign against, which is just going to take things from bad to worse. And I saw a comment, Nicholas, that you flagged, that in a way things can get so bad that it serves the interests of the government, because you have so many dependents, you know, grant recipients increased by like 8-9 million in the last year, to the point where there's pretty much 3 grant recipients for every income earner. This is a situation that unfortunately is politically stable, because people will become loyal to the hand that feeds them, even if the same hand is denying them the dignity of being able to add value to society. Because when we're hungry, we get very short-sighted, we get very desperate, and we don't see the bigger picture.
So, exactly.
I mean, it's a perfect circumstance for
disaster. You know, one of the ANC's strongest campaigning tools that they don't flight in the media, but they do flight on the ground, is by saying that opposition parties will take away your grants.
Which is a perfect segue to our next topic.
Yeah, well, so we've got a big old fight looming about mandatory vaccination. We kind of mentioned it briefly yesterday on the show, but Gabriel wanted to get into it today a bit. We haven't seen, I think, much concrete from the government per se about how this should be done or what should be done. But there has been some stuff that's not great in the media, and I'm sure Gabriel will get into that in a minute. But I just wanted to read something which is quite amusing. So, you know, the vaccine mandate thing is interesting because of how it kind of does shake up some of our traditional political divides a little bit between right and left. The WITS SRC, who I'm sure when they're not issuing this statement that I'm about to read out, is normally calling for the dissolution of private enterprise and the establishment of a proletarian dictatorship, has announced their opposition to mandatory vaccination. It said that the SRC said that that any idea, any push by the University of Wits to have a vaccination policy would divide the campus into a two-tier system of discrimination based on who the institution deems clean and unclean. We cannot set precedent in our democratic society where institutions get to decide who is worthy of their basic freedoms and rights and who is not. As usual, SRCs are always very strident in their language. This is in contrast to the South African Human Rights Commission. It said, no basis for any sort of constitutional challenge to a vaccine mandate. It's completely okay. It's not usual, I think, that you see those two, that you see the WITS SRC on completely the opposite side to the South African Human Rights Commission, and yet here we are. So, Gabriel, your thoughts on this issue, because I know you recently did a video for the Center for Risk Analysis. You should check out their YouTube channel, by the way, on this exact topic.
Yeah, so the first thing to note is that on Sunday, Ramaphosa did say that vaccine mandates are now coming under review. Secondly, let's distinguish between private companies and households saying, you know, if you want to come over for dinner, you've got to be vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated, you're not welcome. Or if you want to come into our store, you've got to be vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated, you're not welcome. Freedom of association is a classical liberal to me, is a sacrosanct right. People want to do that. They should do that. If they get punished economically or they get rewarded economically, that's for the market to decide. Those costs will be borne out by individuals that make those decisions. When I'm talking about vaccine mandates, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the government forcing you to get vaccinated. And, you know, sometimes this is talked about in terms of nudges, like, okay, you don't have to get vaccinated. No police person is going to come up like a nurse and sort of bend you over and stab you in the buttocks with a jab. But if you refuse to be vaccinated, then you're not welcome to use public transport. This is sort of how the Austrians and Germans talk about it. By the way, the Austrians and Germans at least are sophisticated enough to say that if you can prove you've already been infected and recovered, then you don't have to be vaccinated. They call it 2G, Genesen and Geimpft. If South Africa had that, 80% of us are probably recovered, so the vaccine mandate would apply to almost no one. But much more than that, we don't have public transport. The train tracks have been ripped up from Cape Town through to Whitebridge.
We talked about that yesterday. You can't find a train that works.
So there is no incentive. So
there have also been some even softer recommendations. Like I think in some US states, they offered to enter people into a lottery if you got vaccinated, and then you got a big pile of money if you won.
Yeah, look, if the government wants to throw taxpayer money at that, I think that it would be much better than whatever's coming out of half the salaries they're paying, because at least be no illusion that you're actually doing work. I'm not against that particularly. What I am against is Adrien Bosson, chief editor of the largest news platform in the country, saying that SASA grant recipients should not be getting their grants unless they get vaccinated. So if you look at the statistics of the number of South Africans that are below the bread line and that are literally only able to eat because of those SASA grants, you are threatening millions of people with starvation. Not since the Soviet Union have I heard someone in public threaten millions of people with starvation in order to get what he wants. And nobody laughed, and very few people even shook their head. As far as I can tell, this was received as a fairly good idea. It was then followed up by Mandy Wiener writing a thing for News 24 in which she said, look, guys, this is not the time for self-preservation. I'm going to say that because it's a direct quote. This is not the time for self-preservation. So we should starve the poor and not worry about self-preservation. Because why? Because we need to mandate vaccines. Because why? And both of them say, because that way you can stop a new Omicron, a new variant from emerging in South Africa. This goes completely against science. The scientific consensus since January this year has been that COVID is going endemic. That means it's never going away, or it's going to stick around at least as long as I do. And as long as it sticks around, it's going to mutate. We're not sure why it mutated here. By the way, one of the reasons it might have mutated here, according to a professor whose name suddenly escapes me. Can I alt-tab to find it? No, I can't. Gregory Monfieu, something like that, is that, but this has been widely discussed by various others, is that an immunocompromised person, probably someone with HIV, had this thing for a very long period. And if it stays in one body for a long time, it might get a chance to do special mutations. So what, strong, should we take all HIV positive people and put them in a, Sarah, what's the word? A ghetto.
Yes.
A concentration camp.
A gulag.
Should we take all HIV people, make sure that they are force-fed with antiretrovirals or that they're force-fed with vaccines? Should we single people out like that? Because that's one reason the mutation might have emerged. Sounds completely crazy to me. Zero COVID is impossible. Vaccinating people to stop mutations is ridiculous. Vaccines drive mutations. In fact, here's a fun bit of good news. It might be that Omicron is relatively less deadly precisely because it evolved in this environment with 80% plus natural protected and some vaccine protected. So that meant that unlike Delta, the main challenge for it was not transmitting from A to B. The main challenge for it was once you get into B to survive against the immune protection. So you evolve escape abilities, but the more the vaccine is, the virus is incentivized to evolve those escape abilities, the less it is incentivized to evolve transmissibility abilities. So we might have, precisely by screwing up so badly, being the first to achieve, you know, convalescent protection levels at what one would have called herd immunity, which I don't like because it's not 1-0. Some people will still get it, some people will still die. But we might be at the endemic endgame where vaccine mandates make the least sense. But because our political class is so insane that it's willing to support the top media journalist in the country in terms of numbers, saying we should deprive, we should threaten millions with starvation, because the host of 702 every midday says that you should abandon the thought of self-preservation, which is fundamental right enshrined in the Constitution. And anyway, we might actually have vaccine mandates forced by the states just to cover up the fact that we're looking at a fourth wave of high cases and low deaths. I mean, that could turn out not to be the case,
but I mean,
it seems plausible.
Are we even able to vaccinate our population fast enough? What, like, if they put in a vaccine mandate tomorrow and we did it at full speed, assuming everyone complied and everything went 100% perfectly, we still don't have the capacity to vaccinate, what, more than 250,000, 300,000 people a day? It's going to take months to get everyone vaccinated. I mean, so what, are the people at the end of the queue just not going to get their grants? Because, anyway, sorry, your thoughts.
Just stop.
No. I'm going to make a confession. I did not think these words would ever leave my lips. But Eusebius Mackayser wrote about it being a moral duty, not a mandate, a moral duty for medical reasons to get vaccinated. And give or take, I pretty much agree with him. As I said, I never expected to ever agree with anything he says. But essentially, he's saying, you know, you've got to up the education. Because our education's been very sort of removed. I mean, it's the same. It was the same situation where, when AIDS was very infectious. I mean, it was a real problem. There was a lot. There were a lot of programs of public awareness. The minute the antiretrovirals actually shown to be effective, any information, any education just ground to a halt. So what you have is a situation where you needed this level of ongoing education so you stop people. There's still too many people who are HIV positive, and particularly men are HIV positive. It has a lot to do with not taking medication properly, etc. But at the end of the day, it requires carefully created large-scale education above all. And vaccine mandates, no, look, you're just not, our government is just not going to have the vaccinations at hand, the processes to get into areas that are going to be able to do the vaccination you want. You basically want to educate people to a point where they will come to vaccination sites to be vaccinated, and make those sites as available as is humanly possible. But to threaten livelihood, literally, It's unconscionable.
Yeah.
If I can just add on the education point, I'm fully for education. You know what? All of us need an education. Discovery has estimated in a very rough way that 80% of the population might have been infected before the end of the third wave. Now, I think the way that they came to that conclusion is wrong, but I think the conclusion might be right. That's a maybe. Good bit of education would be turning the maybe into certainty. Devastating thing would be if it turns out that actually only if 80% of us are previously infected, this is all very academic. We're going to go into the fourth wave. It's going to be like the UK's been, high cases, low deaths, whatever you do. But maybe only half the country's been infected and the estimates have been completely wrong. That is also called education, getting information that no one has through research. The IRR is the South Africa's best expert at realizing that what the talking heads are all on about is often completely divorced from what reality is on the ground. We do surveys, random statistical, demographically representative surveys. We should do a virological survey, a seroprevalence survey. They've been done in the United Kingdom extremely well, in all kinds of countries extremely well. You can do them very cost effectively and figure out how many people actually have this. Because I think if you did such a survey and you found that only half of South Africans were infected, and then you communicated that widely, a lot of people that are kind of in the complacent position of, you know, I've got some people in my family who swear they've had COVID 17 times, but they've never been infected. So they're not worried about getting vaccinated because, like, oh, I've had it, it's going to be okay. If they hear, dude, people have been saying 80%, but it's actually 40%, then they'll go and get vaccinated. That'd actually move the needle. And if it turns out that 80% or 90% have been infected, and then people stop getting vaccinated, what's the big issue? Then we can move the fight to where it should be if we're in the endemic endgame, which is completely disbanding the command council, ending the state of disaster, prioritizing respiratory diseases like TB, other diseases like HIV, getting back to the very serious hard work of growing our employment numbers, which at this stage already will certainly, our unemployment numbers are going to cause more deaths than COVID over the next 20 years for sure. Like, we can get back to prioritization. I would like to know that information. I would like to therefore have that information. None of us can educate each other about that because at the moment we're dealing with estimates where we should be having hard data.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And
Can I
it
just
just
say that
because
as, yeah, can I just say that as a sort of layman who, you know, looks at these things on a fairly shallow level, from an ordinary person's point of view, the information about how many people have been infected, how many people have died, they're just numbers. They don't mean anything. They communicate nothing of value to ordinary people. They are good statistics for those who need the statistics, but they don't, you know, from a point of view of communicating what can make a difference, they don't make a difference.
I
Let's
think
agree to disagree.
I think Gabriel's point though about getting data speaks to the fact that so much of response to COVID generally has been driven by kind of an incoherent scrabbling about and sort of weird hysteria and like political tribal group think, as opposed to actually like taking the time to consider that, you know, maybe there's a little bit more nuance to these things, and maybe we should actually try and find out information rather than just, you know, going balls to the wall, so to speak.
Yeah, so my theory about the man on the street, as it were, is not that he or she is able to find the solution or make the inferences, but that most people can smell a fish. Most people can tell when you're saying we need 80% of people to get vaccinated so that we stop future mutations. They're like, hold on, haven't a lot of countries done that, but they still have lots of cases? Like, most people know that a vaccine is non-sterilizing. That's a fancy word, but most people know that if you get the vaccination, you can still catch the disease and pass it on. So making the moral argument, don't get vac you know, get vaccinated so you don't pass it on, people are like, hold on, that doesn't make sense. And likewise, I think most people know if you just stick to the message, if you've never had this before, you've got a 1 in 1,000 chance of dying if you're above the age of 45 or whatever. And if you get vaccinated, then it becomes a 1 in 1,000,000 chance. that's like, okay, well, that's a good reason to get vaccinated. When you start confusing it with all the other stuff, get vaccinated to save your neighbor, even though you could still infect your neighbor, get vaccinated so there can be no future mutations, even though clearly other countries have gotten 90% vaccination and they're still spreading the disease. Then people are like, what are you talking about? If you, and look, it's a hard reality. If you have caught it, your odds of dying are so low from reinfection that I don't think you're going to convince almost anyone to take it to save their own life. So that's the cost. If all you want to do is spread vaccination, saying, look, we grant that if you've caught it, it's not that urgent to get revac, to get a booster, you're going to have lower vaccine numbers. But if you can identify people that haven't caught it and prioritize vaccinating them, then you'll actually do the good work of saving lives. And I don't care about cases. I care about lives. And I think that's the good work to be done in terms of spreading vaccines.
Indeed. All right. Let us end there. I hope you enjoyed the show. And we will be back tomorrow, of course, on the Daily Fringe Show. Remember that this is the last week of our show for the year. We will be possibly back with a special sometime in the year, but this is our last week of normal episodes until 12th of January next year. But anyway, hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you then. Cheers.